Hey everyone, welcome to Office Hours with Cloud Posse, your weekly dose of insider DevOps trends, AWS news, and Terraform insights, all sourced from our Sweet Ops community, plus a live Q&A you can't find anywhere else. It's July 3rd, 2024. I'm your host, Eric Osterman. Real quick, I'm the founder and CEO of Cloud Posse. We're a DevOps accelerator for funded startups and enterprises and helps teams who are overwhelmed with AWS succeed by leveraging our over 200 plus Terraform modules that have been battle tested and downloaded over 100 million times. So no matter where you find yourself on this journey, we are here to help your team launch better products faster so you can free up your bandwidth for innovation. So if you're curious to see what it looks like and how it works, just book a meeting with me directly. Go to cloudposse.com/meet. Again, cloudposse.com/meet and answer a few quick questions and we'll jump on a call and go over everything. So, how can you maximize today's session? Well, first off, our format is very informal. Engage as much as you'd like, ask questions. And if you're curious about any of our open source tools or modules, go for it. And for those on the recording, we host these calls live. Don't miss out. Join us live by going to cloudposse.com/officehours. Again, cloudposse.com/officehours. I do have one ask. If you find any portion of today's office hours valuable, please share it with your team. Just head over to youtube.com/cloudposse and you'll find the recording there. You can also join us live on Slack by going to slack.cloudposse.com. All right, some news and announcements. Okay, first one, man, this brings back memories of high school. It felt like OpenSSH was getting exploited all the time back in the day. These hardcore root code executions are less and less common, obviously, as a lot of things have been done in OpenSSH core to mitigate it. Now, this is called cleverly so regression because it's actually a literal regression in OpenSSH. There was a previous bug fix to fix, I believe, this exact execution vector. But at some point it came back. It only affects systems that are on glibc. So if you're running, for example, OpenSSH on Alpine, which uses Musl, then it shouldn't be a issue for you. And it's serious because it doesn't even require a user account or anything else. You just create a malformed SSH packet over the TCP connection. And that causes a buffer overflow and drops you in as root on the host. Anyone look deeper into this?
We've been having some interesting discussions with GitLab about this because we run our own self-hosted instance, and it utilizes the Helm chart, which has a vulnerable version of OpenSSH in it. And currently, we reached out to them and we said, "Hey, are there any plans of remediation or a security fix or even an announcement?" And they got back to us and they were like, "Nope, like in about 10 days, we'll have something out there. We'll have some updated packages that you can pull in." And so we're like, "Okay, we're gonna have a internet
Wow.
exposed, RCE vulnerable service that's just sitting out there." So it's kind of been a scramble here trying to remediate that and move over to another implementation of SSH so that we can kind of avoid this.
No, it makes actually it puts things into perspective. Also for everything else running SSH, like Home Assistant and other things. I mean, this is going to have ramifications for years to come. Now that another
And
big exploit like this. So.
I saw there is a couple of proof of concepts out there with actual, exploitation code available. So,
Really?
yeah.
Oh, it's going to be a, I say, it's going to be a great fall season for spyware and ransomware. And can you imagine the number of appliances that have this that are going to be hard to upgrade? Oh my gosh. All right. I guess that's it.
Watch out for
Office.
your car.
Yeah. Just which cars have OpenSSH running? Do Teslas have it somewhere? Really? Really? I had no idea. Huh.
Yeah, it's running a Linux kernel, and it has the ability. That's how they get diagnostics off of it.
Wow, that's kind of cool. Huh. I know there are these competitions every year to root the Tesla, but I didn't realize they also had Shell. Cool. All right, next announcement. Yeah, small one. For those of you using Atmos, we are publishing Docker images now, so you can get the official Docker images for Atmos. This bundles, to make it very practical, it includes a lot of the common tool chains that you use together with Atmos, including Terraform, OpenTofu, Helm file, kubectl, Helm diff, and that's all I can think of right now. But that's kind of all the stuff under the hood that's used, depending on your stack. And that's hosted on the doc, sorry, on the GitHub container registry, not on Docker Hub. Now, I know I've been doing a lot of announcements lately on badges. It's kind of, I feel kind of goofy spending so much time looking for badges and discovering badges. In a ironic sense, developing readmes on GitHub brings me back to MySpace days when everybody, is coming up with all these ways to style your MySpace. No one does that anymore. So GitHub is the final frontier in customized styling on a platform like that, and badges are one of the ways. So this is interesting. These are similar but different from the Shields you might be familiar with. So Shields is a separate organization with a, backed by a community producing shields for anything you could imagine out there with a public API. These are badges specifically, or buttons rather, as they call them, basically badges, identical to shields in that sense. But when you click on any one of these, it gives you a way to customize it for your preferences. And if you're developing, for example, GitHub apps, or you're trying to get things to look nice within the GitHub UI, like in your GitHub summary jobs or in issues, then these badges could be something you might want to use. All right. There's, obviously some self-serving interests in these posts coming out lately. But just to highlight someone else emphasizing this, a few months ago we talked about Once, which is a new product from DHH and his company. They're launching lots of related self-hosted products that you pay once for each major version. So you can stay on that version, receive all the updates, and only pay once. And then they have an incentive to create it. Additional versions, and you pay to upgrade to those versions. Here's another article. It's obviously by a company that happens to be distributing their own product that way for self-hosting. It's a e-commerce product, I believe. Or sorry, expense tracking product, I think. But it just resonates with me as a smaller company. Look, you save a lot of money with SaaS in the long run, provided you can afford the SaaS for the long run. But if you ever have a slowdown and you need to cut back your expenses, you have like no other option. So you cannot choose when features are removed, when features are added, when prices go up, when you are strictly on SaaS. And that can be harder on smaller companies with more constrained budgets. So I think this is an interesting movement that things are kind of coming full circle. Everything used to be self-hosted, then everything went to SaaS, and now there's kind of a resurgence of self-hosted again as some companies realize SaaS wasn't for them. Matt, I know you have a lot of opinions on this.
Yeah, I was just gonna say I heard that it's an option you can check a box at checkout, and they send you the software on floppy disk. It's great.
Yeah. And there's a service where you subscribe to what was it, Slackware, or what was the CD subscription? Oh man, I heard of those back in the day.
I mean, yeah, like, I don't know. I keep getting on, like, I keep getting sucked into DHH land every time something happens. But like, comparing the cost of subscribing to a SaaS service to just the costs of the software, and not taking into account hosting infrastructure and knowledge and effort it takes to maintain and keep those things running, you know, at some sort of scale, is always disingenuous to me. And it's like, you know, well, yeah, we got off of AWS by, you know, by buying a bunch of servers, is not a valid argument either. Like, you know, where are you hosting those servers? Who's performing maintenance on them? Who's, you know, who's dot 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 dot? You know, and I keep feeling like we're getting but we keep getting sucked into that same argument over and over again, and it just seems it always just seems disingenuous to me.
Pepe, I see you raising your hand. Do you have something to add?
You're muted, Pepe.
Yeah, if you're talking, we can't hear you.
Sorry. I used to work in Sonatype, the creators of Nexus IQ. And you know, there is a niche of people that really need self-hosted things. And we actually offer a self-hosted version of Nexus IQ, SaaS version that you deploy yourself within a cluster that is air gap. But it's funny, I completely agree with what Matt said. People don't really realize how much of a burden and all the costs associated with it, because and it's funny because the price of that service was $250,000. So imagine charging $250,000 for you to deploy your own clusters with, you know, 3 terabytes of MySQL database and a bunch of other things. So and there was a huge team of people building the air gap version of the SaaS service behind it. So it's kind of funny the contrast of people don't really realizing how much of that, even for a SaaS company that's actually building the product, that is doing this type of service, how much of that effort is.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, it's also it's also compounding. I could imagine if this is one of, you know, two or three things you need to manage or take care of, it's maybe more debatable. But when you start stacking these things up, it's insurmountable. And I mean, this is what we experienced at Cloud Posse in the early days when we thought, hey, we're just going to find every open source alternative of the mainstream kind of product that you need and stick it on Kubernetes. And good news, you're not going to have to pay for a single SaaS software. You just have your Kubernetes cluster. And what happened? Year one, not a single product updated. Year two, still 2 years behind on all of that. Now, afraid to update everything, not sure what's going to happen when you update it. And I get it. So, that was specifically a problem when you have so many services. I'd say, even at Cloud Posse right now, I'm going back and forth on this. I feel like for a long time, it made sense for us on this one product that we were using, Metabase. And it's been more or less turnkey and self-sufficient. But now I realize how much we're starting to pay to maintain it when different things are going wrong between the database filling up, or, well, okay, an ancillary service not directly related, but stitch data, sending data to the database. And then the EKS cluster that it's running on being close to the EOL end of life version for EKS, and then the cost of EKS skyrocketing as soon as that happens if we don't upgrade the cluster. And then because, you know, I'm not the one doing it, I have people on my team doing it. It costs us money as a company to do all those things, which far exceeds the cost of the silly, you know, $100 a month SaaS subscription. So I have humility in that too. And I don't know what the right answer is. But I'm starting to think the SaaS looks more attractive all of a sudden. All right. Let's move on. Okay. So just wanted to highlight something. We're running a special at Cloud Posse here with. Basically, we are offering the entire Cloud Posse reference architecture in a DIY model. So you can do it yourself for your organization following our documentation. We'll hand you all the configurations if you just sponsor us. So with a GitHub sponsorship enterprise tier, you'll get access to our team for the duration of your sponsorship, 2 times a week. On our customer workshops, you can ask any questions. You can get help on the keyboard, PEPCAC issues. You can get help triaging things. You can get asked strategy questions, anything. You have access to our team 2 times a week, every month. So consider a GitHub sponsorship if enterprise sponsorship. If you've always wanted to use our reference architecture, but you couldn't afford a full freight engagement where we come in and implement it together with your team, do all the training and all that, we still offer that. That's what we call our jumpstart. But the GitHub Enterprise is the easy way to get what we offer here. So what do you get with that? It's insane how much you get with it. You have access to literally the entire Cloud Posse reference architecture pre-configured in an opinionated manner following our best practices. So any module you see here is more or less included in that configuration. So EKS, Argo CD, self-hosted GitHub Action Runners, AWS account management with Terraform, organization management with Terraform, Amplify, GitHub OIDC, so you can run all your GitHub actions with over OIDC to assume roles in AWS so you don't have any hard-coded credentials, your databases, ECS if you want to go that route, Lambdas, network firewalls, VPCs. I mean, there's pretty much nothing that we don't include in it. So if you're interested, reach out, book a call with us, and we'll share links for that. So you can find out more information, and you get that with a GitHub sponsorship of Cloud Posse. Any questions? All right. Oh, I'll just show you one quick more thing on that. To do a GitHub sponsorship, it's real easy. Whether you sponsor us or other projects that you believe in, it's more or less the same. An important thing to know is that you can sponsor as an organization, not as an individual. So on the Cloud Posse sponsors page, you go down here, you see enterprise sponsor, you click select on that, and then you can sponsor as your organization, provided you have permission to do that. And then you just click, sponsor, and you're good. And monthly, that sponsorship kicks off, and it helps us out a great deal. All right. Last one. So last week we were talking about how Slack or Salesforce has decided that Slack for communities is never going to be a thing. They are not going to suddenly provide an option that makes it practical economically for smaller communities to upgrade to a paid plan. I was secretly hoping that because they were preserving the history, that they had the option on the table, that they were going to introduce a affordable option. One of those options would be, how amazing wouldn't it be if individuals could upgrade their Slack subscription in a community so they can see at least the history, but not have to pay for the entire community? I think that would have been cool. Well, that's not happening. And they are at the end of August shutting it down. So we've been maintaining our own archive at Slack, sorry, at archive.sweetops.com. It's going to remain there. We're going to change the host name and everything. But the problem with the way we're doing this is relying on the feature of doing a full export from Slack. And that's not going to be possible when they shut down, when they delete the history after 90 days. But Linen is the alternative to that. They support imports, and this was, a reminder by Jim Park. So thank you, Jim, for bringing this up last week. So it supports importing, and they don't charge for that. Some of the other services I tried out, they wanted to charge over like $1,500 to do a one-time import. No way. So Linen's doing that for free. And plus, you add Linen as an app to your Slack community, and then it just ingests the messages as you go. So it'll have a running history. So I think this is kind of the happy medium. It's very disruptive to switch from Slack to Discord to something else and get everyone to move. And then the history is never going to be really smoothly migrated over. So I think even though Slack is continuing to just rub me the wrong way, I think this is the lesser evil. So yeah, just want to say that if you see a change in our Slack archive in the coming month or two, it's moving over to that. Yeah, did they ever fix in IRC the ability to have history? I know there are like these hacks that you can do, and there's forks of various versions of IRCD or Unreal IRCD that added history, but it was never. I started on IRC, and someone's talking about IRC, but I mean, Slack is an improvement on it, of course, in my personal opinion.
Yeah, you always had to export it onto like a journal or a history, a third party website or whatever.
So it comes full circle.
It's fine. We don't need history.
Yeah.
If look, communication should only exist for 24 hours.
I don't know if I fully agree with that, but I could understand if that I was, doing things, talking with my buddies regarding stocks and the, publicly traded markets, that why I would really support that. But no. Okay. So that was that. Those are my announcements. Anyone else have announcements?
Well, I don't know if you announced it last time, but Atlantis basically got approved as a sandbox
All
project.
right, yeah.
I know you announced it in LinkedIn, but I just wanted to say thank you to whoever, voted for Atlantis to be approved as a sandbox project. There was a lot of work on doing that, a lot of social engineering that we need to do to better describe what cloud native means in this stage and age, but we went forward, and now, well, we need to do all the rest of stuff for the incubation process and all that kind of stuff. So thank you
Yeah.
to everyone that helped.
Yeah. So now you can actually get started on it, really. You were in a holding pattern until that.
Yeah. Well,
So that's great.
you know what is funny is that the Atlantis is basically ready to be incubated. There is very few things that we are missing from the incubation requirements perspective. So we went to Sandbox because we were told to do so, but I was actually going to apply for incubation right away because you can bypass it if you fulfill all the requirements. So we were just missing one, which was, I believe, was the real cases of people using it. What is it called?
Testimonials or case study.
Case studies of Atlantis being used and kind of like in blog post format, so that people can, use those as guides for the infrastructure or whatever. So
Understood.
we are starting building that out now. So some people are creating blog posts for us, and soon we will have that done. But yeah.
That's so cool. So, how are you guys behind the scenes? How this is working, Pepe? Do you have like a weekly or monthly call, or how are you coordinating the effort?
No, so we don't have monthly calls. So basically, the Cloud Native Foundation has the TAG meetings, and the TAG meetings are in a public schedule, and that's when they vote or whatever. So the problem with that is that if they don't talk about your project and the day that they said that they're going to talk about your project, then you have to wait like 3, 4 months. So that's why it has been so long
Oh,
to get around this. And especially if like they're going to vote and someone says, well, but I don't agree if Atlantis is a cloud native project, which kind of happens with us. And so then there is discussions about it. It's like, is it cloud native? Because, well, it doesn't run in Kubernetes as well.
Well,
but it
cloud
does
native only works with Kubernetes, right? You can only be cloud native. Kubernetes.
Yes. So that was the discussion we had. So so basically what happens is that when we went to present into the OpenTofu conference in Paris, we talked with the tag team, and basically Dylan, which is the other maintainer, is now part of the tag team for projects like Atlantis. So he's volunteering there, and plus Chiru, the other maintainer, he has a lot of contacts in the tag team too. So we have always had a channel back to talk back and forth, and like, what do we need to do, who we need to talk to, and so on. So that back channel has been pretty helpful for us to actually come to this point. So.
Cool. Well, thanks for the status update, Pepe. And to hear what you're up to with that. Go ahead, man.
I was just going to ask a question about the CNCF, designation. So Kubernetes is a CNCF project, right? So what did they do? How did they have a CNCF before they had Kubernetes? It seems like a chicken and the egg thing.
Yes, yeah. A lot of that came about.
Only runs on
yes. Them. It's kind of like, how do you run Kubernetes without having an IP? So then everything else that is not outside Kubernetes is because it's not a requirement for Kubernetes. You know, it's like the chicken and the egg and everything, you know? So like Cilium, is it Cilium a cloud native project? I don't know. It's a networking thing for Kubernetes, but is it? I don't know. So there was a lot of confusion in that sense, because it's kind of like, and I think it is related to the fact that they don't have that many people to support all these projects. So they can't just accommodate all these new projects coming in. I mean, if you look at the history of all the projects that are trying to get to the CNCF, there are a ton of them. And there's not enough people for the tag team to like review every single one and help them through and get someone assigned to each project and all that kind of stuff. So it's understandable that they are trying to like trim, you know, the amount of incoming projects and make them more tailored to certain, you know, definition of what cloud native means.
Is there any list? I'm just curious, it just made me think about it. Is there any list tracking projects that have graduated?
All the projects
have failed. Failure rate.
That's a good question. I know that you can track all the ones that the issue was closed, because those are fulfilled, but you will have to track the ones that got voted. Within there's a Git voting bot in each one of the issues, so you have to track that to see if that happened. Because if the vote wasn't successful, 66% of the votes were not in favor, then that project will not be incubated.
Cool. So switching gears, and only because I see Matt Gowie is on the line, because he hasn't been here for a little while. I did have a question for you, Matt, from months ago, but you haven't been on. I was really curious. In one of your write-ups about like the tool chain that you use at Masterpoint, I think you mentioned this, Linear. I was just curious, or GitStream by LinearB.
I didn't know it was by Linear. But yeah, we use it in one of our clients. I would say it adds like a tiny little, for what we're using it for, it adds like the smallest little nicety, which it gives a PR a label that defines it as, hey, it's going to take this amount of time. I think that's what we're using GitStream for. I'm going to need to go and look at PRs that have it running on it. But I know, you know what? If you scroll down, I'm looking at that report, that comment. And I remember looking at that, and I know at least when we used it, we might have removed this type of stuff. Maybe we removed it entirely. I can give you an answer if you give me a couple minutes.
Because that seems to be always the outcome for so many of these kinds of review tools that I've seen, is like, on the surface, they look pretty cool, but then you start interacting with it and it's really just noise. the signal to
Yeah,
noise
it can create a lot of
ratio.
noise. Yeah. Comments, I think, are hard in particular, where you almost want something between a comment where it's like kind of permanent, or it gets added to the description or something like that. That would be useful. That gets updated. That would be a GitHub probably project in itself, but or feature in itself. But yeah, I don't know. I think it was that they got noisy with comments.
Okay,
I know
that.
that Kevin on my team would have an opinion. I remember he hated it, if I'm
Okay.
remembering correctly. But it's been a while. It's been a while. So I'll have to go and look at PRs and see what, if what I'm thinking we use it for right now, which just adds like, hey, this is a 5-minute review. This is a 20-minute review. This is a 30-minute review. Is that like worth it? I mean, it's like a free service, so it's
Yeah.
not like a major deal. I don't
I
know.
don't, yeah.
Let me circle back around. If I have anything useful to say, I'll share.
Yeah. Okay. So I guess just to highlight, we're saying what this is saying. So based on the files that changed, this will add a comment saying these are the other people who worked on that same code that might be a good reviewer based on what they worked on previously. Okay. So that was that. I had that topic about. All right. I had some other filler topics I really want to talk about, but I don't know, Michael, did you want to talk about your project Terramate or?
Yeah, I'll take a crack at it. I wasn't expecting to be doing a demo today, so we'll see. Hopefully the demo gods are nice to me. But yeah, recently I've kind of
I'll
wanted
stop
to.
sharing.
Oh, sorry.
I'll stop sharing so you can
Oh
share your screen. Go ahead.
yeah. Let me see. Oh no. I'm not allowing Zoom.
Oh, and you haven't done, you're a little meat person.
If you want to hit another topic, I can quit and reopen it
Okay,
and
well, yeah, why don't we talk about one other thing and come back to this, time permitting. All right, let's see here, back to here. Okay, so I wanted to talk about this, and since Pepe, are you still here?
I was going to say, let's not talk about that because otherwise he's not going to have time for a demo.
Yeah, so I don't know. This was a conversation. There's no right or wrong answer. There's just a good kind of discussion going on. Actually, it was Matt Gowey who posted it on LinkedIn, and then he got everyone here to respond to him. He has a trick for doing that. Matt, you're pretty good at baiting, nerd sniping me and others.
I don't expect to. I'll say that. I kind of expected this to just kind of be simple. But then other people really disagreed. So,
Yeah.
and there was a couple good reasons behind be apply before merge. Like I
Yeah.
still apply after merge. I still think that apply after merge is the right way to go. But like I now have maybe a better understanding of why people want to apply before merge.
So let me set up the topic here. I'll try to do it in a less biased way because obviously I have a bullet in the race. Here's the issue with Terraform. There's been a long-standing debate with how you apply it in automation. If you think about the software you generally come to deploy, things that are containers or going back even before the container age, you're using, oh, help me, what's the tool that everyone used to sync to, via SSH? There's a Ruby tool. I don't know. Anyways, regardless.
Capybara.
Capistrano.
Oh, Capistrano. Yeah, not Capybara,
Yeah.
Capistrano.
Capistrano, right? So
Yeah.
yeah, that's how you date yourself, at least in relatively recent terms with deployments, is that you're using Capistrano pre immutable infrastructure. But okay, so in that situation, almost always you merge your pull requests and you deploy. So the same was true in Capistrano, same for true for Kubernetes. Containers and Helm manifests and, or sorry, Kubernetes manifests, Helm charts, etc. So Terraform, is in an interesting category because of how it's come about. In the early days of Terraform, most companies probably were running Terraform entirely on workstations or like some bastion host, right? There was not really much automation. And as teams started to struggle with how to work or collaborate with Terraform in a distributed environment, that changed. So, you know, some were using Jenkins, some were using, you know, whatever, CircleCI or whatnot. And then a project, Atlantis, comes out, which Pepe was just talking about. And Atlantis is now this incubator candidate for CNCF. And Atlantis invented, I would like to say, the way to deploy Terraform in an automated manner for the longest time. It pioneered on issue ops, if you will, or GitOps, and if you will, or chat ops, a way of talking with the service to run plans, to run applies. And one of the things that it did, controversially, at least in the beginning, is require that everything is applied in your pull request before merging. And it makes a lot of sense in a lot of ways, because Terraform can fail in so many ways. Terraform is notoriously bad at, or vulnerable to having a successful plan, but the application of the plan failing. Maybe permissions were wrong. Maybe certain things are only validated by the APIs, the cloud APIs themselves. So the plan isn't aware, for example, that some instance type doesn't exist. And so forth. The other thing is, it really sucks when you are developing Terraform and you only find out afterwards that it fails. If you've already merged into your default branch like main, now you got to open another pull request and apply those changes. And that's unfortunate. So, let's see here. So anything before we get into, you know, should we apply before or after we merge, anything else I missed out on we should cover here? All right. So in the Atlantis community, Pepe, correct me if I'm wrong. Atlantis does support something like you apply after merge these days, but it's not the default, right?
No, it doesn't support that.
Still doesn't even support it. Okay.
No. We have a big discussion going on about that. Yeah.
Yeah. So, so it's very opinionated, therefore, in this way that you can only apply before it merges. And on the one hand, that seems totally reasonable. And like, if something is going to fail in main, why don't we just make sure we fix it before we merge? And the problem is how Terraform works. So Terraform will only apply the changes of the delta. And there are many times when you're developing in this model of pull requests with Terraform and Atlantis, that the first time maybe you apply something, it fails. And the second time you apply it, it works. Or let's say you're taking an iterative approach to developing your Terraform code. So you start with something very simple, which is, you know, maybe provisioning the VPC. And then your next commit, you add some resource that depends on the VPC. And you can end up creating basically cycles, where when you're taking this iterative approach of applying Terraform one commit at a time, more or less, that it works when you do it that way, but it doesn't work if you started from scratch. And now the code that you have is undeployable, actually, if you started from scratch. And that's what happens when you do apply before merge. Now, if you do apply after merge, because you are doing fewer merges, presumably, and less iterative deployments, presumably, it reduces the likelihood that you create cycles. It doesn't eliminate it. But what it does show is that you still, whether you do apply before merge or apply after merge, it still means you have to have some way to reconcile that what you have in your main branch is deployable. Because even after you merge into main, it can stop working. Whether you use apply before merge or after, it can stop working for many reasons. You're not pinning your providers. You're depending on data sources that change or go away. You have somebody that, you know, does manual changes to your infrastructure. Now I'm talking more about drift. So I'll pause there for a second. Anyone have something they want to add?
Go ahead.
I see just Michael raised his hand, so I was just calling him.
No, yeah, I was fired up by this post as well. So I commented on it, and I'm firmly in the apply after merge camp. And mainly in my case, the intent of the code is already in place after you merge that PR, and that merge should kick off the pipeline that actually applies the code to your resources. So if that apply fails, the code, you shouldn't be changing the code, in my opinion, or at least in my experience, the problems that come from applying that merge are on the provider side. Specifically, I'm talking about AWS. And in my experience, we ran out of IP space, or something else was wrongly configured on the AWS side. So we would fix things on the provider side and then just rerun the pipeline, like you say, on the second apply, and it works, not because we changed the code, but we changed the environment where the code was being applied.
That makes sense as another scenario. That's an epic background, by the way. It looks pretty cool.
Thanks.
Pepe.
Well, the thing is that, obviously I'm biased, but...
that makes this interesting.
Yeah. So the thing is, like, for example, the argument you were saying about the VPC, it is true that you can obviously hit limits which can actually make an apply to fail. Now, if you have the PR still open and you're going to reapply twice because that failed, you can still require the status for the apply to be successful within the PR. Therefore, you always make sure that the apply was successful before it was merged and not after. So the cycles in that sense are not so relevant if you build sequentially like what you were mentioning, because how many times the VPCs change? So once a VPC is up, you know, people will create their own Kubernetes clusters and they have naming conventions. So hopefully that those are not going to collide. So they can be almost independent from that underlying infrastructure.
So let me describe the scenario in a different way, kind of, though. It's this idea where it's not that, okay, so you're not wrong, Pepe. You can ensure that this was successfully applied before merging into main. And that is true regardless of what I'm about to say. The problem is that it is masking a cycle that the code itself is referring to something that could have only worked if it was first created before it was added. But it was created before it was added because it was done iteratively with one apply, then the code changed, then another apply. And now that cycle worked because I applied it in that way. You know, like when you run Terraform and you have to run the dash target argument, that's the thing I'm trying to avoid. So
I have a separate point, but I want to make sure I'm clarifying. I think, Eric, you are explicitly talking about something that applies on every commit. That can cause that problem.
Which, commit, but yeah.
Or... Yeah, I mean,
iterative applies basically. Whether you do it on every commit or every 10 commits,
versus like apply versus commit can also be. I mean, apply before merge can also be something like, okay, I'm done with my PR. I label it and then it gets applied, and then if it succeeds, I merge. And the same thing can be achieved without doing iterative applies there. So I'm not necessarily saying that they're. You know, I was just clarifying that you're talking about something that is being applied multiple times throughout the life cycle of a PR.
Exactly.
But that wasn't actually why I raised my hand. The reason I raised my hand was because I wanted to say the thing that bugs me the most about apply before merge is that I no longer have a single source of truth of what I expect the state of the system to be. And for me, that's the main branch. So like if I, let's say that someone applied all that stuff, but they didn't merge their PR, they go on vacation for 10 days. I look at Maine and I don't see any of their changes, but the infrastructure is out there live at that point. And then I want to make a change to something. I can destroy what they did, and I can also have a false sense of what I thought the previous state was of, you know, infrastructure before I made my changes. So I think that that's where that method falls down for me, is that it just it becomes very confusing because now we have multiple sources of truth. And if two people happen to be working on the same thing at the same time, you know, we can do things to gate the fact that only one successfully merged PR is applying to the same like stack at a time, but you can't do that very easily with, or I mean, obviously, like with tools,
Atlantis
some tools you can. Atlantis, you can, but like, so not every tool, you know, or not every solution allows you to do that. Like if you're running in Jenkins or GitHub Actions or whatever, it becomes a lot harder to do that kind of thing to prevent two people from applying to the same resource at the same time, which is, you know, which is tough. And even with Atlantis, you lock a stack or you do whatever, like it still doesn't prevent me from making a change to a resource that the two open PRs are fighting with each other because like somehow I adopt like another resource accidentally or
something
like that.
Into another project, for example, and now you have a problem. So
yeah,
it's
exactly.
Optimistic locking. It's a non-adversarial solution.
So, I mean, to me, that's the biggest challenge, is that it just doesn't, like, the reason we have like a trunk-based development approach is because you have short-lived branches and then you commit back. And when you commit back, that then says this is the current, you know, state of affairs. And then, you know, I've always lived by my main branch should always be deployable. You know, philosophy. And if you haven't merged those other things and there's live infrastructure out there, then your main branch is no longer deployable. And that's kind of the danger from my perspective.
All right, Pepe, any final words on that one?
No, I agree with all those comments. And that's why I said in the LinkedIn post that for this to work well, you know, apply before merge, you have to have good communication and hopefully some sort of separation between certain type of resources. Like, you know, in Atmos, you do the workspace per component, which kind of alleviates a little bit of this problem and makes people to be able to work in different parts of the infrastructure without stepping each other's toes. And the other thing too is that when you're working, like it all depends of the flow of how you apply infrastructure, because then you can argue that, you know, main will be promoted to other higher environments. So if main is not the source of truth at some point in some time, it will be before it gets to prod. So you obviously, those are the cycles that you're talking about, where you are going to create maybe other PRs to fix other things to actually get it to the promotion state. So there's a lot of, you know, communication process, I guess it's a better word, that is required for this to work very well. But yeah, that's all.
Yeah. And I'll just add one more thing. I think that the other danger of doing this in a of doing it with like applying before merge in the Terraform ecosystem, from my perspective, is that there still isn't a great there isn't a canonical, well thought out and universally accepted way to share data between modules if you're not using like Terraform Enterprise. So we all resort then to using outputs or state of other components. And if you are iterating on a component and changing its state, but without committing the code, anyone that relies on that implied contract, whether we have a an explicit contract or not between them, it's very confusing for them to understand what's going on, because they look at the code and they're like, well, this property doesn't exist in there, or this property doesn't exist anymore. Why doesn't it exist? And then you have to track down like open PRs to figure out like why that might have broken, et cetera, et cetera. So I think, my opinion, it's just a lot messier with collaboration at large scale, particularly when we use that method. But I can see both sides of the argument, but I personally prefer, applying after merge.
All right.
Yeah,
Well,
even I second that. Like, I've worked in a big organization previously, and like we were migrating some of our existing infrastructure, and one of the original repositories that housed all the infra did like the apply before merge, and that would cause a lot of issues, similar to what Matt said. And like with the apply after merge, let's say I forgot to even apply, right? Like the post mentioned, like the next pipeline that does run ends up applying, and let's say it breaks for them. It's easy to track like which commit kind of broke that and things like that. In the other case, it's a bit more trickier. You have to kind of go see all the existing pipelines that are running and things like that. So while it's broken in main technically, but it's easier for everyone to kind of just rebase and then like apply changes or even revert commits,
Makes sense. All right, well, let's pause there. I wanted to check in with Michael. Do you have it working?
Yeah, I think I should be able to share now, hopefully.
All right, why don't we try it and see? So I'll just give a quick intro. So Michael has been working on a side project to take a pass at implementing pretty mermaid diagrams for Terraform plans or plan files. This is a difficult problem. There's a few people who have tried to solve it over the years and we've talked about it other times on office hours. And I know this is an early project and you're just an early start here, but I thought it'd be fun to show everyone kind of what you're working on.
Yeah. So like you said, my goal for 2024 was to get better at writing Go code. So that's kind of where this started from. I was thinking of projects that I could test out where I'm incorporating Go and Terraform and kind of like just experimenting in the ecosystem. And I was like, hey, who doesn't like great diagrams when it comes to like mermaid and such? So I took a stab at creating Terramade, which is a tool that basically just like it says, harnesses Terraform's graph functionality and converts dot into mermaid. So that's kind of like the current state that it's at. It's in its early iterations, and there are a lot of limitations, but I'll just do like just a very basic quick demo in this directory, if it'll ever load. I just have a simple main.tf that has a couple of resources in it, and what I want to do is just run Terramade by itself. And this will actually use graph functionality and generate a markdown file that has mermaid written to it. So I will run that and it creates a Terramade file. And you can specify like the output file. And here is where basically it just creates some mermaid from the resources that exist there. So actually, might be easier to see it in VS Code. So this, yeah, like I said, it's kind of early, early stages. I know it gets difficult when you're doing a plan or you have like a bunch of resources that are affected. You know, looking at a mermaid diagram there, it gets pretty convoluted and ugly really quickly. So I think the next iteration for me is probably incorporating, you know, a truncated view that gives you kind of an overview of like what's going on. And then you can open it up and get kind of a better picture of what's actually happening. So, yeah, that's currently where it's at. And, it's just been a fun project. If anybody has any, you know, recommendations or resources, you know, this has just been like a fun learning project that, trying to make it better, trying to get it, you know, very, clean and not super noisy so that it can be integrated into pipelines.
Michael has his hand up. I had a question.
Maybe. Yeah. I think this is pretty sweet. The one suggestion or request that I had was if you could interface or consider interfacing with something like Gauntlet or a templating thing.
Okay.
So I have projects that have existing README files, and it would be totally cool to say, hey, this is where the stuff is going to go with just handlebars or something like that.
Okay.
And then I could run Terramade in CI/CD. It injects it into the README file, or maybe even before. Injects it into the README file, and then that gets committed back to the repository. So then everything's all captured and codified.
Yeah, awesome. Terraform Docs does this, and ironically, we were just digging into this an hour before office hours. But yeah, it looks worse. Matt,
that's already built in. It's called sed and awk. Come on, man.
Yeah.
True. True.
Yep. So the other interesting considerations, Michael, from my perspective, would be well, I think what's going to happen is there's no one way to do it. So config options is probably going to be a requirement. One of the two of the patterns I've seen in the others is like how you handle modules. So you could treat a module as a black box and not show all the resources, the module provisions. You can just say, hey, here's what we do here in this module. And then it references these other ones. That's one way to compress the graph and reduce the information. Hmm. But then that should probably be a feature flag, because the next person is going to say, no, I want to see everything in every module. And then, you know, well, their mileage may vary.
That's true. Yeah, that's a good thought.
Yeah, you could also use in Mermaid, you can also use links, obviously, to have multiple Mermaid diagrams that are like rendered into into Markdown sections, and then you can link between them using that. The other thing, I'm working on a project that is using Mermaid pretty extensively for something we'll reveal at some point, I guess, or into the future, but one of the things was having the option of determining what to do when you have a large number of things. So like if you have, you know, 25 bucket things that get rendered, maybe you just, you kind of group them by resource type and say, you know, parentheses 25 or something like that. And then also the orientation of the diagram is the other, it should be, you know, possibly another configurable option, like whether you want it top down or left to right. You know, those are two, you know, two possible things that that you might want to consider, but looks pretty cool.
Yeah, thank you.
Yeah, that was a great recommendation about the compression there, Matt. Like grouping, like if it's just like if you have a factory, which we didn't get to talk about today, but if you had a factory producing, you know, 25 DNS records, you might not need to show all of those. You can just show 25 A records. Would be the thing there. And dynamically looks compressing like, how many resources.
Yeah, I was just going to say, it looks like Robert has his hand up too. He has.